Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 16. As the Skylark approached the shore, its occupants heard a rapid succession of detonations, apparently coming from the direction in which they were traveling.
"Wonder what that racket is," Seaton said. "Sounds like big guns and high explosive. Not atomic, though."
"Chuck," Duquesne said, "even allowing for the density of this air, that kind of noise is not made by pop guns."
Seaton closed the lock to keep out the noise and advanced the speed lever until the vessel tilted sharply under the pull of the engine.
"Go easy, Seaton," Duquesne cautioned. "We don't want to stop one of their shells. They may not be like ours."
"Easy it is. I'll stay high."
As the Skylark closed up, the sound grew heavier and heavier. It was one practically continuous explosion.
"There they are," said Seaton, who from his board could scan the whole field of vision. "From port 6, 5 o'clock, low."
While the other four were making their way to the indicated viewpoint, Seaton went on.
"Aerial battleships. 8 of them. 4, about the shape of ours. No wings, act like copters. But I never saw anything like the other 4.
Neither had Crane, nor Duquesne.
"They must be animals," Crane decided finally. "I do not believe that any engineer anywhere would design machines like that."
4 of the contestants were animals. Here indeed was a new kind of animal, an animal, able and eager, to engage a first-class battleship. Each had an enormous torpedo-shaped body, with scores of long tentacles and a dozen or so immense wings. Each had a row of eyes along each side and a sharp, prow-like beak. Each was covered with scale-like plates of transparent armor. Wings and tentacles were made of the same substance. That it was real and highly effective armor, there was no doubt, for each battleship bristled with guns, and each gun was putting out an almost continuous stream of fire. Shells bursting against the creatures filled the region with flame and haze, and produced an uninterrupted roll of sound appalling in its intensity. In spite of that desperate concentration of fire, however, the animals went straight in, beaks tore yards-wide opening in holes. Flailing wings smashed superstructures flat. Writhing, searching tentacles wrenched guns from their mounts and seized personnel. Out of action, one battleship was held while tentacles sought out and snatched its crew. Then it was dropped, to crash some 20,000 feet below. One animal was blown apart. 2 more battleships and 2 more animals went down. The remaining battleship was half-wrecked. The animal was as good as new. Thus the final duel did not last long. The monster darted away after something which the observers and the Skylark saw for the first time. A fleet of small airships in full flight away from the scene of battle. Fast as they were, the animal was covering 3 miles to their 1.
"We can't stand for anything like that," Seaton cried as he threw on power and the Skylark leaped ahead. "When I yank him away, Mart, sock him with a Mark 10.
The monster seized the largest, most gaily decorated plane just as the Skylark came within sighting distance. In 4 almost simultaneous motions, Seaton focused the attractor on the huge beak of the thing, shoved on its power, pointed the engine straight up, and gave it 5 notches. There was a crash of rending metal as the monster was torn loose from its prey. Seaton hauled it straight up for 100 miles while it struggled so savagely in that invisible and incomprehensible grip that the thousands of tons of mass of the Skylark tossed and pitched like a rowboat in a storm at sea. Crane fired. There was a blare of sound that paralyzed their senses even inside the vessel, and in the thin air of that enormous elevation there was a furiously boiling, furiously expanding ball of what? The detonation of a Mark 10 load cannot be described. It must be seen, and even then it cannot be understood. It can scarcely be believed. No bit large enough to be seen remained of that mass of almost indestructible armor. Seaton reversed the bar and dove straight down, catching the crippled flagship at about 5,000 feet. He focused the attractor and lowered the plane gently to the ground. The other airships, which had been clustering around their leader in near suicidal attempts at rescue, landed nearby. As the Skylark landed beside the wrecked plane, the Earthmen saw that it was surrounded by a crowd of people. Men and women identical in form and feature with themselves. They were a superbly molded race. The men were almost as big as Seton and Duquesne. The women were noticeably taller than the two Earth women. The men wore collars of metal, numerous metallic ornaments, and heavily jeweled belts and shoulder straps, which were hung with weapons. The women were not armed, but were even more highly decorated than the men. They fairly scintillated with jewels. The natives wore no clothing, and their smooth skin shone a dark, livid, utterly strange color in the yellow, bluish-green glare of the light. Their skins were green, undoubtedly, but it was no green known to Earth. The whites of their eyes were a light, yellowish-green. The heavy hair of the women and the close-cropped locks of the men were a very dark green, almost black, as were also their eyes. "What a color," Seton said wonderingly. "They're human, I guess, except for the color, but great cat, what a color." How much of that is pigment, and how much is due to this light is a question, said Crane. If we were outside away from our daylight lamps, we might look like that too. Horrors, I hope not, Dorothy exclaimed. If I'm going to, I won't take a step out of this ship, so there. Sure you will, Seton said. You'll look like a choice piece of modern art, and your hair will be jet black. Come on, give the natives a treat.
Then what color will mine be? Margaret asked.
Oh, I'm not quite sure. Probably very dark and very beautiful green. He grinned gleefully. My hunch is that this is going to be some visit. Now wait till I get a couple of props. Shall we go? Come on, Dot.
Roger. I'll try anything once.
Margaret.
Onward, men of Earth.
Seton opened the lock, and the five stood in the chamber, looking at the throng outside. Seton raised both arms above his head in what he hoped was the universal sign of peaceful intent. In response, a man of Herculean build, so splendidly decorated that his harness was one gleaming mass of jewels, waved one arm and shouted a command. The crowd promptly fell back, leaving a clear space of 100 yards. The man unbuckled his harness, let everything drop, and advanced naked toward the Skylark, both arms aloft in Seton's own gesture. Seton started down. No, Dick, talk to him from here, Crane advised.
Nix, Seton said. What he can do, I can, except undress in mixed company. He won't know that I've got a gun in my pocket, and it won't take me more than 30 minutes to pull it if I have to.
Go on, then. Duquesne and I will come along.
Double Nix. He's alone, so I've got to be. Some of his boys are covering the field, though, so you might draw your gats and hold 'em so they show.
Seton stepped down and went to meet the stranger. When they had approached to within a few feet of each other, the stranger stopped, stood erect, flexed his left arm smartly, so that the fingertips touched his left ear, and smiled broadly, exposing clean, shining, green teeth. He spoke a meaningless jumble of sound. His voice, coming from so big a man, seemed light and thin. Seaton smiled in return and saluted as the other had done. "Hail and greetings, O High Panjandrum," Seaton said cordially, his deep voice fairly booming out in the dense, heavy air. "I get the drift. I'm glad you're peaceable. I wish I could tell you so." The native tapped himself upon the chest.
"Nalboon,"
he said distinctly and impressively. "Nalboon," Seaton repeated, and then said in the other's tone and manner, while pointing to himself, "Seaton."
"Seaton,"
Nalboon said and smiled again. Again indicating himself, he said, "Domak Gok Mardonale." This was evidently a title, so Seaton had to give himself one. "Boss of the road," he said, drawing himself up with pride. Thus properly introduced to his visitor, Nalboon pointed to the crippled plain, inclined his royal head slightly in thanks, or in acknowledgment of the service rendered, Seaton could not tell which, then turned to face his people. With one arm upraised, he shouted an order in which Seaton could distinguish something that sounded like, "Seaton Bazavirogd." Instantly, every right arm in the crowd was aloft, that of each man bearing a weapon, while the left arm snapped into that peculiar salute. A mighty cry arose as all repeated the name and title of the distinguished visitor. Seaton turned. "Bring out one of those big four-color signal rockets, Mart," he called. "We've got to acknowledge a reception like this." The party appeared, Duquesne carrying the rocket with an exaggerated deference. Seaton shrugged one shoulder, and a cigarette case appeared in his hand. Nalboon started, and in spite of his self-control, glanced at it in surprise. The case flew open, and Seaton, after taking a cigarette, pointed to another. "Smoke?" he asked affably. Nalboon took one, but had no idea whatever of what to do with it. This astonishment at simple sleight of hand and ignorance of tobacco emboldened Seaton. Reaching into his mouth, he pulled out a flaming match, at which Nalboon jumped straight backward at least a foot. Then, while Nalboon and his people watched in straining attention, Seaton lit the weed, half consumed it in two long drags, swallowed the half, regurgitated it, still alight, took another puff, and swallowed the butt. "I'm good, I admit, but not that good," Seaton said to Crane. "I never laid him in the aisles like that before. This rocket'll tie him up like pretzels. Keep clear, everybody." He bowed deeply to Nalboon, pulling a lighted match from his ear as he did so and lighted the fuse. There was a roar, a shower of sparks, a blaze of colored fire as the rocket flew upward. But to Seaton's surprise, Nalboon took it quite as a matter of course, merely saluting gravely in acknowledgment of the courtesy. Seaton motioned his party to come up and turned to Crane. "Better not, Dick. Let him keep on thinking that one boss is all there is." "Not by a long shot. There's only one of him. Two of us bosses would be twice as good." He introduced Crane with great ceremony as boss of the Skylark, whereupon the grand salute of the people was repeated. Nalboon gave an order, and a squad of soldiers brought up a group of people, apparently prisoners, seven men and seven women. They were of a much lighter color than the natives. They were naked, except for jeweled collars worn by all, and a thick metal belt worn by one of the men. They all walked proudly, scorn for their captors in every step. Nalboon barked an order. 13 of the prisoners stared back at him, motionlessly defiant. The man wearing the belt, who had been studying Seaton closely, said something, whereupon they all prostrated themselves. Nalboon waved his hand, giving the group to Seaton and Crane. They accepted the gift with due thanks, and the slaves placed themselves behind their new masters. Seaton and Crane then tried to make Nalboon understand that they wanted copper, but failed dismally. Finally, Seaton led the native into the ship, showed him the remnant of the power bar, indicating its original size, giving information as to the number desired by counting to 16 upon his fingers. Nalboon understood, going outside, pointed upward toward the largest of the 11 suns visible, and swung his arms 4 times in a rising and setting arc. He then invited the visitors to get into his plane, but Seaton refused. They would follow, he explained, in their own vessel. As they entered the Skylark, the slaves followed.
"We don't want them aboard, Dick," Dorothy protested. "There are too many of them. Not that I'm exactly scared, but..."
"We've got to," Seaton decided. "We're stuck with them. And besides, when in Rome, you've got to be a Roman candle, you know." Nalboon's newly invested flagship led the way. The Skylark followed, a few hundred yards behind and above it.
"I don't get these folks at all," Seaton said thoughtfully. "Now, they've got next century's machines, but never heard of sleight of hand. Class 9 rockets are old stuff, but matches scare them. Funny."
"It is surprising enough that their physical shape is the same as ours," Crane said. "It would be altogether too much to expect that all the details of development would be parallel." The fleet approached a large city, and the visitors from Earth studied with interest this metropolis of an unknown world. The buildings were all of the same height, flat-topped, arranged in random squares, rectangles, and triangles. There were no streets, the spaces between the buildings being park-like areas. All traffic was in the air. Flying vehicles darted in all directions. But the confusion was only apparent, not real, each class and each direction having its own level. The fleet descended toward an immense building just outside the city proper, and all landed upon its roof, except the flagship, which led the Skylark to a landing dock nearby. As they disembarked, Seaton said, "Don't be surprised at anything I pull off. I'm a walking storehouse of all kinds of small junk." Nalboon led the way into an elevator, which dropped to the ground floor. Gates opened, and through ranks of prostrate people, the party went out into the palace grounds of the emperor of the great nation of Mardonal. It was a scene of unearthly splendor. Every shade of their peculiar spectrum was there in solid, liquid, and gas. Trees were of all colors, as were grasses and flowers along the walks. Fountains played streams of various and constantly changing hues. The air was tinted and perfumed, swirling through metal arches in billows of ever-varying colors and scents. Colors and combinations of colors, impossible to describe, were upon every hand fantastically beautiful in that strong, steady, peculiar light.
"Isn't this gorgeous, Dick?" Dorothy whispered. "But I wish I had a mirror. You look simply awful. What kind of a scarecrow am I?"
"You've been under a mercury arc like that, only worse. Your hair isn't as black as I thought it would be. There's some funny green in it. Your lips, though, are really black, and your teeth are green."
"Stop it! Green teeth and black lips? That's enough. I don't want a mirror."
Nalboon led the way into the palace proper, and into a dining hall, where a table was ready. This room had many windows, each of which was festooned with sparkling, scintillating gems. The walls were hung with a cloth, resembling spun glass or nylon, which fell to the floor in shimmering waves of color. There was no woodwork whatever. Doors, panels, tables, chairs were made of metal. A closer inspection of one of the tapestries showed that it too was of metal, its threads numbering thousands to the inch. of vivid but harmonious colors, of a strange and intricate design, it seemed to writhe as its colors changed with every variation in the color of light.
Oh, isn't that stuff just too perfectly gorgeous? Dorothy breathed. I'd give anything for a dress made out of it.
Order noted, Seaton said. I'll pick up 10 yards of it when we get the copper.
We'd better watch the chow pretty close, Seaton, Duquesne said, as Nalboon waved them to the table.
You chipped it, copper, arsenic, and so forth. Very little here we can eat much of, I'd say.
The girls and I will wait for you two chemists to approve each dish then, Crane said. The guests sat down, the light-skinned slaves standing behind them, and servants brought in heaping trays of food. There were joints and cuts of many kinds of meat, birds and fish raw and cooked in various ways, green, pink, brown, purple, black, and near-white vegetables and fruits. Slaves handed the diners peculiar instruments, knives with razor edges, needle-pointed stilettos, and wide, flexible spatulas, which evidently were to serve as both forks and spoons.
I simply can't eat with these things, Dorothy exclaimed.
Oh, that's where my lumberjack training comes in handy, Seaton grinned. I can eat with a spatula 4 times as fast as you can with a fork. But we'll fix that.
Reaching out apparently into the girl's hair, he brought out forks and spoons, much to the surprise of the natives. Duquesne and Seaton waved away most of their preferred foods without discussion, then tasting cautiously and discussing fully. They approved a few of the others. The approval, however, was very strictly limited.
These probably won't poison us too much, Duquesne said, pointing out the selected few. That is, if we don't eat much now and don't eat any of it again too soon. I don't like this one little bit, Seaton.
You and me both, Seaton agreed. I don't think there'll be any next time.
Nalboon took a bowl full of blue crystals, sprinkled his food liberally with the substance, and passed the bowl to Seaton.
Copper sulfate, Seaton said. Good thing they put it on at the table instead of the kitchen, or we couldn't eat a bite of anything.
Seaton, returning the bowl, reached behind him and came up with a pair of salt and pepper shakers, which, after seasoning his own food with them, he passed to his host. Nalboon tasted the pepper cautiously, then smiled in delight and half emptied the shaker onto his plate. He then sprinkled a few grains of salt into his palm, studied them closely, with growing amazement, and after a few rapid sentences, poured them into a dish held by an officer who had sprung to his side. The officer also studied the few small crystals, then carefully washed Nalboon's hand. Nalboon turned to Seaton, plainly asking for the salt cellar.
Sure, my ripe and old, in the same mysterious way he produced another set, which he handed to Crane.
The meal progressed merrily, with much sign language conversation between the two parties, a little of which was understood. It was evident that Nalboon, usually stern and reticent, was in an unusually pleasant and jovial mood. After the meal, Nalboon bade them a courteous farewell, and they were escorted to a suite of 5 connecting rooms by the royal usher and a company of soldiers, who mounted guard outside the suite. Gathered in one room, they discussed sleeping arrangements. The girls insisted that they would sleep together, and that the men should occupy the rooms on either side. As the girls turned away, 4 slaves followed.
"I don't want these people, and I can't make them go away," she protested again. "Can't you do something, Dick?"
"I don't think so. I think we're stuck with them as long as we're here. Don't you think so, Mart?"
"Yes, and from what I have seen of this culture, I infer that they will be executed if we discard them."
"Huh? How to—" "Huh, could be. Yeah, we'll keep them then, Dot."
"Oh, of course, in that case, Well, you keep the men, and we'll take the women.
He turned to Crane, saying under his breath, "They don't want us sleeping in the same room with any of these gorgeous gals, huh? I wonder why." Seaton waved all the women into the girls' room, but they hung back. One of them ran up to the man wearing the belt and spoke rapidly as she threw her arms around his neck in a perfectly human gesture. He shook his head, pointing toward Seaton several times as he reassured her. He then led her tenderly into the girls' room, and the other women followed. Crane and Duquesne, having gone to their rooms with their attendants, the man with the belt started to help Seaton take off his clothes. Stripped, Seaton stretched vigorously, the muscles writhing and rippling under the skin of mighty arms and broad shoulders, as he twisted about, working off the stiffness of comparative confinement. The slaves stared in amazement at the display of musculature and talked rapidly among themselves as they gathered up Seton's discarded clothing. Their chief picked up a salt shaker, a silver fork, and a few other items that had fallen from the garments, apparently asking permission to do something with them. Seaton nodded and turned to his bed. He heard a slight clank of arms in the hall and began to wonder. Going to the window, he saw that there were guards outside as well. Were they honored guests or prisoners? Three of the slaves, at a word from their leader, threw themselves on the floor and slept, but he himself did not rest. Opening the apparently solid metal belt, he took out a great number of small tools, many tiny instruments, and several spools of insulated wire. He then took the articles Seaton had given him, taking extreme pains not to spill a single crystal of salt, and set to work. As he worked, hour after hour, a strange, exceedingly complex device took form under his flying fingers.
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Till then, watch the skies.